accession number 3998, reel 3.
Major Hasek, tape number 3. You were telling me about the vehicles.
Yes, well then, apart from the, we had quite a lot of problems with, of course, the heavy sand in those days, and as we gradually became more experienced, so we were able to travel further per day. Our main restrictions was the problems with water and overheating the vehicles, and of course we had to always be pretty careful of fuel, because some of our trekking was going from one point to another, the other point being perhaps 3 or 4 days away, and according to the terrain, so it would affect your petrol consumption quite considerably, and consequently this was sometimes quite a problem. And I always remember a rather harrowing experience I had. Whenever petrol had to be carried in bulk, in the early days, I liked to be the driver of the vehicle carrying the bulk petrol, which was only in the old flimsy Safirs, as they were called in Arabic. That is the 4-gallon flimsy tins, which would burst open at the slightest provocation. And we were down in the Nuba Mountains with my company, I think it was number 2 company at the time I'm talking about, and we were running out of fuel, and we still had some work to do down the Nuba Mountains before we returned to El Obeid, which was the nearest fuel depot, so I had to return with a 30 hundredweight truck to El Obeid and get 30 hundredweight of fill up with these 4-gallon petrol tins. On returning, I found to my horror that a bush fire had started. And this had gone on, I suppose I'd gone the day before, and no sign of a fire, but coming back the next day, this fire was right across my track where I wanted to go, as far as I could see. So I drove along to the east, thinking that the fire seemed to have come away from the east, was going to the west. And it looked about, it wasn't very deep in depth as far as crossing it, but it was pretty fierce. And the vegetation was mainly dried grass with the odd acacia tree. Approaching the Nuba Mountains, the terrain becomes rather rocky and more scrubby, and fewer acacia trees than there are in the middle of Kordofan province. So that here it was more or less dried grass that was on fire, with the odd bush and the odd acacia tree. But I was frightened, there were a lot of sparks, it was fairly windy, there were a lot of sparks, and I was rather terrified, quite honestly. I only had 2 native soldiers with me, and I really didn't know what to do. So anyhow, I was on my own, really, because the native troops, they're dead scared anyway, they know that petrol will blow up. And so they wanted to jump off the lorry, but I tried and coaxed them to stay on, and nothing to worry about. And I drove about 3 miles till I just came to a dead end as far as driving my vehicle was concerned, because there was a deep core, deep riverbed, which I couldn't get down with the vehicle. So I had to turn back, and if the fire was still too severe to really chance it, and so I drove back westwards about another 5 miles, and the fire was just getting bigger as the wind was from east to west at this particular time. So I decided that the fire was least on the part of the eastern side had already gone past, and And I drove up and down till I found what I thought was the narrowest part, only about 200 yards. It was nothing very severe in things I've heard of since, and when you see proper bushfires. But when you have a vehicle full of petrol, and you know that some of these flimsy tins do leak, then even a spark is enough to make you get a bit worried. Well, then I said to my two native soldiers, I said, well, the best thing you can do is run across. You run across there and wait for me. Well, we had a 4-gallon tin of water, and we had a tarpaulin over the covering the petrol. So before I let the troops go, I got them to open the 4-gallon tin of petrol, and we drenched the tarpaulin with water, with all the water. We put it onto the tarpaulin, and then I let them run across, which they did with just one or two small burns on the legs, and as a result of running through this small fire. And by this time, the grass was quite black, and all that was coming up were being blown up by the wind. Were a few fragments of fire and sparks and dead grass and that still alight. So I went about 100 yards back from the limit of the fire and put the vehicle into low gear and belted across like the clappers. And with my heart in my mouth, and just praying that I didn't bump into any unseen wadis or small river beds that I wasn't able to see because of the smoke. But anyhow, I managed to get through, and that was that. And that was by the way. And these were the sort of little things that you used to have to sometimes get with and cope with when you were by yourself and nobody else to ask or anything. And other times you'd sometimes have rather unpleasant accidents where perhaps a lorry had overturned, a troop carrying personnel vehicle had overturned, a tire had burst, and the troops had no experience of skidding or controlling a vehicle. It was very difficult to try and teach drivers to how to control a skid when you were in sandy terrain, because it was very difficult to make a vehicle skid, so that we could only tell them in theory in the main. But when we got into the newer mountains, then the terrain was much harder, and no sand or little sand is more cotton soil, and there the roads were quite firm. And in the sandy country, you used to run your tyres at low pressure. And then the hard terrain, of course, your tyres, you had to put them up to the normal pressures. Well, this was quite good, but if there was any rain about, a shower that made the cotton soil quite skiddy, sometimes the vehicle would skid. And when we were down there training, I would devote some of the time trying to teach the drivers how to rectify skids, but this was extremely difficult because there was very little room off the beaten track. The roads were not metalled or anything like that. They were purely roads that had developed from tracks, and mainly in valleys adjacent, or perhaps it had been made into roads by the local natives under the supervision of either the district commissioner or some public works chap, but they weren't proper roads by any means. And consequently, there were very few and far between areas where you had a sort of area where you could drive a vehicle and put it into a skid, other than on these narrow roads. So consequently, and also the native troops seemed very difficult to train into steering into a skid. They would tend to steer the opposite way, which of course caused the vehicle to overturn. And sometimes we'd have these nasty accidents where a tyre would burst and a troop truck would overturn and in some cases perhaps kill some of the troops on it. And this happened to me a couple of times in the Nuba Mountains, and each time we were transporting Nubian troops from a town called Dilling, which was one of the headquarter towns in the Nuba Mountains, and was a Nuba company in the Camel Corps. And each time they had these accidents, if I recall rightly, two or three of the Nuba troops were killed. And again, another difficulty was when the troops were not in convoy, although the vehicles were governed, the carburetors were governed, these, some of the drivers were quite crafty and knew how to overcome the governor mechanism. And consequently, they could alter the governors to so that the vehicle would drive at a pretty fast rate. And this, again, was the cause of accidents. And another bugbear was, with them being Camel Corps troops, when they used to pull up to camp or stop for a rest break, as Camel troops, they drive very close together, and they're just like troops marching. The camels are practically touching, and the same goes whether they're in line or in column. And consequently, it was very difficult to teach the drivers of the vehicles to stay 30 feet apart when they pulled up. And several times, especially, this was especially difficult in the sandy terrain where they were having to give the vehicles quite a lot of revs, and then they'd suddenly realise the vehicle in front was pulling up, and they were revving too much, so that they would put the brakes on, and although the vehicle would pull up pretty quick, they were perhaps revving a little bit too much, and would get too close to the vehicle in front before they stopped. So that they like to be close to the vehicle in front, although they shouldn't be. But this sometimes did have problems and caused concertina crashes, because you'd find that you'd get three or four vehicles would stop very close to each other, back to front, nose to tail, in other words, and then along would come a Happy Joe and bash the car at the back, and of course with concertina results. And on two or three occasions, I had to rush into El Obeid from the training area and get a new supply of radiators, and which didn't please the powers that be in El Obeid very much. But this was a problem. We did have little problems like that with the native troops. They were very good, but very loyal, and as good as gold. And if they did anything wrong, they accepted the punishment.
How did you get on with the native troops, the British NCO?
Extremely well. Extremely well. I had one or two disciplinary dues with them. Once, whilst in El Obeid, we were on trek from Barra, my PC, we were going down to the Nuba Mountain area, and we'd stopped for the night in El Obeid, and this particular night some of the troops decided they'd go and visit the local forbidden area, and we think that they got a bit drunk, and they pinched a car. It happened to be my car, which in those at the time was my brand new V8, and this was our first trek from Barra. So We found that they smashed the car up, of course. They had an accident and didn't smash it very badly, but they caused damage to it, and they had to be punished. And as it was a serious offence, the company commander remanded them to the Camel Corps commander. And at the time, a company commander could award 10 lashes. That was his maximum. And the commander of the Camel Corps could award, I think it was 30 lashes was the maximum. That was, other than that, it was a court-martial. And in this particular case, if I remember, I think the culprit was awarded 15, or perhaps there were two of them, awarded 15 lashes. The lash, by the way, was a camel whip made of rhinoceros hide, which was about 6 feet in length, 5 to 6 feet in length, and tapered from a thickness of 1 inch to nothing, so you can tell. And the punishment was on the bare bottom with a wet handkerchief over the cheeks of the bottom, meted out by the senior sergeant major. In this particular case, by the senior sergeant major on the head, native sergeant, of course, the native sergeant major on the headquarters staff. But if it was a company sentence, then the same procedure, they just lay down on the floor, flat on the floor, belly down, and the head upon the hands, and the short with the trousers down. They used to wear shorts, actually, and shorts down, and bare bottom just would be the sergeant major would just put a wet handkerchief on the bottom, that to stop lacerations. And then he would carry out the punishment, giving 5 from one side, and then turning round and going to the other side, and 5, and he'd do it sideways like that. So that he was wielding the whip at right angles to the man's body. And in the case of the man who got, I forget whether he got 15 or 30 lashes by the commander, there's the native medical officer present. And if he sees that the men are going under, he stops the punishment. But usually they took the punishment like men. And as a matter of fact, it was a crime and a sort of thing that wasn't done to let anybody, because this was done in front of the company, or always in front of the company on parade in square formation. And when a punishment was carried out, the man being punished never cringed, because this was just, if he did, then he wasn't considered a man in the eyes of the Muslim Arabs. Another incident I had was, I had a couple of sad ones. One was, I had a native carpenter, who was an extremely efficient craftsman, but he took ill. And the trouble with Arab troops, or Arabs I suppose as a whole, if they become ill, they really go down, they really give in. And yet you could see an Arab with something physical, such as a broken arm with the bone sticking out, or a broken leg with a piece of bone protruding from the skin, and that he'd accept that. That was fine. Didn't mind that at all. But with an illness that was something other than malaria, which they could cope with, if it was just an ordinary illness, a debility or something like that, then they didn't know what it was. They just went down and down. Well, this carpenter of mine, he had an illness and we used to send him into the doctor. We had no doctor. We had to send them into El Obeid, to the province headquarters, to see a doctor. And the doctor said it was purely psychological. It was a mental thing. There's nothing the matter with this chap. So we couldn't let him off. We couldn't give him any medicine. But he just got this depression. So he was always asking for leave off. and sometimes being absent and being punished. And as I say, in the workshops, in my workshop, he was a good soldier, but he would be bad as a regimental soldier. In other words, he'd let you down on guards and things like that. He'd disappear. And he was married with his wife in the quarters, and as far as we knew, happily married, no problems. It was purely this mental thing. And he'd no problems in the workshops, and as far as I knew, no problems with the staff, with his mates. But he decided he wanted to go and see his own local Ficky. And that was the only way he'd get better, the Ficky being the witch doctor, as we know it, or the local religious man. He lived about 10 miles away, his village, this soldier, so we let him go the first time, and he came back, and he was fine, marvellous. What the Ficky used to do was give him a prayer from the Quran, write it on a piece of paper, and this chap would eat it. And that made him fine. Well, at first, this lasted a month. And then he wanted to go again. You say, well, then, okay, we will let him off again. Well, then it got so regular that we had to put our foot down on the commander. It had to say, look, we have to stop this, you're going away, because it was 2 days when he was away. Although he lived 10 miles away, it took a day there and a day back, because he had to go by foot, you see. And so it came the time we were going on a very big, I think our annual main trek, when we usually be away about 3 months. And we had all the vehicles loaded up the day before. We were leaving just after dawn the following day, and this was a big parade, all the vehicles ready. And they were under guard the previous night because they were already in line, ready to move off. And this was in Barra, number 4 company. And just before we were due to move off, a couple of days previous, this carpenter had been to see the OC and asked him could he have leave to go and see his Ficky before the trek. And the OC said, no, we can't. You must come with us, you say. We can't allow you. You may not be back in time. So his application was rejected. And he'd had one or two rejected before. But he was very browned off the day before. And anyway, the morning we were going, they came and told us he'd hanged himself. And that was very sad. That was very sad. Another time, we had I'm trying to think of the word, an outbreak of Malta fever, which was a bit rare. Now, as I said earlier, the soldiers could cope with malaria and sandfly fever, which was very prevalent and very common. But this Malta fever, which you may or may not know, is a relapsing fever, was something we'd never had before. Now, just near my garages were two or three small round buildings called tuckles, which were used as the local sick bays. And one of my sergeants, a fine strapping man, about 6'2", a real figure of physical perfection, he went down with this Malta fever. And it was a very nasty thing, very depressing. It's a very depressive illness, and it's a relapsing illness where you're all right for perhaps 1 or 2 days, and then you're very ill, and then you again have a remission period, and then you're very ill again, and you get weaker and weaker. But it is curable, and nobody had died. We'd had several of the chaps go down. But this sergeant was the only one in my workshops who'd gone down with it at this particular time. And I used to go and see this fellow, and I could see he was really letting it get him down. And I'd try and comfort him and speak to him and in any way I could. And sometimes the doctor would come out from El Obeid and see them, sometimes a British doctor, sometimes a native doctor. And there was no question of him wanting to see his Ficky or anything like that. He just accepted the medical attention that the government were providing for him. But he couldn't accept the fact that he didn't seem to be getting better. And he just died. Just died. Dreadful. And to look at this chap, I think I have somewhere a snap of him as he used to be before he was ill. And unfortunately, as I've told you, I can't get at them. But it was a great sadness to me that particular man, because he was a sergeant in charge of one of my vehicle sections, and I'd known him for quite some time. I'd had him with me in number 2 company in Ellerbade, training him before we went back to form the new company in Barry, you know.
Did you have many personal contacts with the African troops?
Other than troops?
No, with the African troops.
What do you mean when you say personal contact?
Well, what were your own relations like with them on a man-to-man basis?
Really, you were pretty distant. You were pretty distant. I suppose the native officers would invite us perhaps once or twice a year. And when I say a year, we used to get 3 months' leave every year, 97 days, actually, so that you only had, actually, around about 9 months on station or in company, you see, on duty. And I suppose once or twice you might be invited round to the senior native officer's house for drinks with the other native officers. Being Muslims, of course, when I say drinks, it was invariably soft drinks. And likewise, the British officers would invite the native officers for drinks once, perhaps, in the year. But as far as contacts with one's troops was concerned, once you finished duty, you never saw them. You never saw them because they lived. The British officers' quarters were in a small compound, and the troops' quarters were about a quarter of a mile away across a maidan. There's no contact at all. And perhaps once or twice a year you would be invited to a company party, which was given in what was called the line.